Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 12th of March. Joining us this hour, the producer of Fields of Fuel, which is a pretty new documentary that looks at a number of issues. It looks at how we started using oil. It looks at how long the earth will have oil. It looks at biodiesel and the promise of biodiesel and the failed attempts of biodiesel. It looks at the pollution that has come from oil refineries, particularly in Louisiana, where the star of the film actually has many family roots. And it looks at cars. It looks at our whole world actually being so dependent on this source that maybe has reached its peak already. Why is it that we don't have, after all these years, some kind of very, very strong alternative to oil? And what does it mean if we don't? What about the amount of oil that the United States uses when you compare it to what other countries use? The film encompasses all of this. And you may remember this guy, Josh Tickle, who had this biodiesel car, the veggie truck, that he took across the country. He was on a lot of national television shows. This is the guy who's featured in the film. And he has gone really all over the world for some 10 years looking for solutions, some alternative energy. He says that his perspective is that all the technology exists, even the manufacturing capacity for the technology exists. For most people who see this film, the takeaway is we can do it. It's not so much a shift in technology as it is a shift in community action and policy. Joining us this hour is Greg Reitman. He is the producer of Fields of Fuel. He's an international entrepreneur and has a background in marketing and technology with, he says, a peaceful creative vision. He founded Blue Water Entertainment in the year 2000, an independent production company focusing on environmentally conscious entertainment. And he is considered to be Hollywood's green producer. He recently produced the 2008 Sundance Audience Award-winning feature documentary that we're talking about, Fields of Fuel, which does present the case for biodiesel as the fastest and most sustainable means to reducing our country's dependence on oil. He's also written, produced, and directed the feature documentary Hollywood's Magical Island, Catalina. And that was syndicated on American Public Television. And he's currently working in production on his new feature documentary film, Rooted in Peace. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Greg. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, it's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hi, Greg. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks. How are you, Kathleen?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm doing well. What's going on?
There's a lot going on. There's always a lot going on. That's why you're around, right? To let us know what's going on. As I was watching the film, I was thinking one of my basic questions was, why in the world did we go with oil to begin with? Why didn't we get rolling on what Henry Ford has suggested, what others have suggested a long time ago, instead of oil, which somebody must have known was finite? Why didn't we just start with wind and solar and diesel?
I think, when I've been around Josh Tickle for about 4 or 5 years, I learned a lot. And one of the things that was, very clear from the onset was that oil was the cheapest, source of energy around. And so it just looked like a very attractive, item. It's like going grocery shopping. When you look at things to buy, if someone says it's $5 and someone says it's $2 and it's the same thing, what would you buy?
Right.
And so that's kind of what happened. I don't think, science really took to heart, the different energy sources and looked at carbon and the impact that carbon would have on the environment. I think we just saw this as a particular energy source that was infinite in its possibility.
Mm-hmm. For those who are not familiar with Josh, you traveled all over the world to put together this film and concentrated on Josh and his family and his Veggiemobile and in Germany and Sweden. I mean, it just goes everywhere. Tell us just briefly the story of Josh.
Josh is a very, very, very unique character.
Yeah, he is.
And he's very, very bright, and he's very dynamic, and he's very committed to his cause. And what you find is an extraordinary human being who really had a traumatic situation that happened to him in Louisiana, where he got to witness, you know, firsthand, you know, a particular area that was filled with petrochemicals and oil. And at a very early age, you know, he was very inquisitive and just started to look at, you know, his natural surroundings and started to question, you know, what was really going on. And there's a high rate of fertility, there's a high rate of cancer, and he just started to correlate these things together. And you know, he used to talk about when he was 16 how he took on, you know, these tests with the EPA, and only to find out that there was true corruption. It's really what led him, I think, on this journey. You know, I think, you know, it's interesting, like certain things happen to us, you know, in our lives that affect us, mm-hmm. you know, and they have, you know, huge effects on our lives. And I think in this situation, you know, Josh living in Louisiana, it really affected his well-being, his personality, his family, and it drove him to, you know, really out of love, to find a solution to cure a very, you know, horrible incident.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, in looking back, I think that's really what was the driving force. And then he just had a passion, you know, for the environment, and it led him to Germany, and it led him to, you know, the biodiesel. And then he was, you know, he was creative and he was innovative, and he got the van, and he, you know, he painted it with sunflowers, and he wanted to you know, self-express and to show people what was possible.
Mm-hmm. I loved, tell the story of his science project when he was, I guess, in high school. He was testing the waters in the bayous and in the Gulf, and found that they were terribly polluted and filled with extremely unsafe chemicals because of the oil industry. And the guy from the EPA said, I should disqualify this project from the science fair. It's a great story.
Well, that was, like I was saying, that was the dramatic moment.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like I said, he was a very highly intelligent human being, still is, and really got, you know, down to the science of what was going on. And when he brought it to the higher powers, they came to look at him and they denounced it. They were like, it was, no one wanted the truth to come out. And I think Josh was driven to bring the truth out. And, you know, like, look, I mean, if it was me, and I was in that situation, it was my family members, I would have done the same.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that he found vegetable oil, and I love the parts of the film where he's stopping at Burger King and McDonald's and Arby's asking for all the oil they have left over. When did he discover vegetable oil, and what made him do this van and take it all over the country to ask for oil to fuel his van?
I think he was, I don't know the exact age, but I think he might have been 19, 20.
Oh, my.
And like I said, he went to Germany and he worked on an organic farm, and he learned about Rudolf Diesel, and you know, and how they could process vegetable oil and make it into and use it as an oil to run in an engine. And I think, you know, what he was really trying to do was to show people what was available, and to show people, you know, that there was another source, and that it was right, you know, in our backyard. And we really weren't doing anything with it. And you know, and he was creative. You know, he was questioning, you know, the modus operandi, you know, the way we operate, you know, our transportation sectors. And he did it in a very humorous way. It's kind of cute when he goes up there and says, I'll take it, all of it, because you know, he's basically saying, it's like, what are you doing with this oil? You know, and you know, why are you wasting it when we could actually be using it as an energy source?
Right. And also the part of the film that looks at what's going on in Germany, or at least was until recently. Can you talk about that? It seems as though there has to be government involvement in order for alternative energy to be given, you know, tax incentives to be able to move forward with alternative energy. What was happening in Germany, and how did that fall apart?
Well, I think Germany is a very innovative, you know, smart, you know, country, and I think you know what, they, you know, obviously Rudolf Diesel, you know, invented the diesel engine, you know, that he was the one who showed the possibility of using rape seeds to run an engine. And I think that, like any smart nation, they saw another energy source that was possible. And so, you know, like, and the farmers, you know, were the ones who were behind it. So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, why would you go and like, I worked on a farm, you know, in Israel. I worked on a kibbutz. And, you know, typically when you're doing communal, you know, farming or communal living, you pretty much use the natural resources that are around to sustain yourself. And I think that's kind of like how a movement begins, or how a farm begins, or sustainable living. And I think that's what occurred in Germany. And it just sort of sprouted, and it was cheap, it was available, it was accessible, and they could put it in their tractors. And I think, you know, that sort of probably spurred a movement, and, you know, in terms of an economy. And like all economies, you know, government's involved in farming and agriculture, so it probably wanted to stimulate, you know, that particular sector so that it would thrive. And I think it probably saw biodiesel as a particular mechanism. You know, now, you know, I'm not sure what's going on exactly in Germany, but I could probably say that I don't think biodiesel is dying. I think that, you know, it's in about, what, 1,000 or 2,000 retail chains all over the country. It's become part of their pop culture, part of their movement. Even, you know, Schmudo, which we see in the movie, I mean, even he, you know, took to heart, you know, the rape seeds and what was available in his race car. So I think it's just like it's an evolution. It just sort of evolved.
Right. So are we looking at problems with soy and corn being used for biodiesel? I know the film goes into maybe the promise of algae. What problems do you see with the use of soy and corn? And are we anywhere near being able to make a switch to something that might be more efficient, that may not cost as much to produce as ethanol does now?
You know, Kathleen, what a great question. And I'm so glad you asked this question, because it's such a fundamental question. When we look at corn and soy, you know, it's kind of like looking at beta and VHS. You remember when beta came out?
Sure.
And it was like the technology, and it didn't survive. VHS became the platform of choice, you know, for the VCR. And, you know, now, look, we have a DVD player, and now we have Blu-ray. You know, in any, you know, revolution or ingenuity or innovation, there's always the primordial technologies, you know, that evolve. And then there becomes, you know, second generation and third generation. And I think in this particular answer, or this particular paradigm, what you have is your traditional food-based crops that were our first-generation, you know, biofuels. And now what's evolved is we have our second-generation, you know, biofuels, which are cellulosic ethanol and algae. And what's really interesting is that, you know, it's not really about corn and soy. What it's really about is being innovative and thinking outside the box and really understanding what alternatives are out there and what's the best mechanism to produce them. And, you know, in this film, we learn about, you know, algae, which you can make out of carbon wastewater. Well, here's a problem that we have. We have too much carbon in the atmosphere, and now we have a particular mechanism where we can actually use that carbon to make fuel to put in our cars. So I think really what the question really is how do we think outside the box and not get caught up into this food versus fuel war, because that debate doesn't really need to happen. Really, what we need to really look at is what are the next, you know, second or third generation technologies that are available that aren't food-based crops that can run our transportation sector. And what's really fascinating, which I learned from Josh, is that there are 1,000 non-edible plants that can make alternative energy. Now, you didn't know that.
1,000?
1,000.
That's a lot.
Yeah. And they're all over the planet. And so that's what I'm talking about. Like, you know, like, look, there's poverty and there's food shortages. Nobody wants to be taking food off of the table. We want to feed everybody in the world. And we also need to grow our economy and be able to move our goods and services around, you know, the world. And we can do it in a very effective way. And it's out there and it's available.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We'll take them in a moment for Greg. He is the producer, Greg Reitman, producer of Fields of Fuel. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email address, if you'd like to send one of those, is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now at 800-486-8655. Peter from Fond du Lac. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine,
today?
How are you, Peter?
My question is, I have plenty of friends who did jump on the biodiesel bandwagon and they ran out and found that 20-year-old diesel vehicle to convert over. But you can't buy diesel vehicles right now because of the EPA standards or more California standards. At least not in the car sector.
Mm-hmm.
So how is that going to get resolved before we can shift over to having a critical mass of enough people buying driving diesel to make it worthwhile shifting over to biodiesel?
Okay. Greg?
A great question, and it's a very complicated answer. What you're really talking about is the cooperation or integration of the, you know, oil or energy, you know, companies working with the automotive companies to certify the fuel standards work in a particular vehicle to run a particular fuel. And that process takes time and can, you know, has been going on for a while. And, you know, we talked with Volkswagen, you know, in Germany, and, you know, and about them, you know, certifying the biodiesel in their fuel. I don't think they've done it yet. And that's been really the particular, it's been one of the bigger issues that's on the table, because, you know, if you put the particular fuel source that's non-certified in your car and something goes wrong, you're liable. And so it's integral that the automotive companies, you know, work with the fuel companies to certify the fuel. And if they don't, then, you know, what you have is an industry that can't work and can't function, you know, in the way that the people would like them to. And that's been probably the biggest obstacle that faces, you know, any new fuel source that comes into the marketplace.
So how long do you think it will be before, I guess the first question is, will those diesel cars, should they be on the market again, can you say that within a couple years or even less than that, some of these 1,000 plants that you mentioned will be able to convert it to biodiesel that will be able to go into those diesel cars pretty much immediately?
Let me be very clear with you, Kathleen. Any diesel engine can run on the biofuel. There's no changes or modifications on the engine at all. What we're talking about here is a certification by the automotive manufacturer certifying that fuel source will work in their car.
Right.
And so what you have here is what we would call bureaucracy of energy companies like Texaco or whatever, ExxonMobil, working with, you know, GM to certify, you know, biofuel and put it into mainstream America.
Mm-hmm.
If that doesn't happen, you can, and what you found is a movement of people, and I did it for 3 years. I ran my car, you know, on biofuel. But if anything went wrong with my car, I'm liable for it. I couldn't go back to the manufacturer and tell them, you know, this is the problem. If they saw the fuel, which they would, in the car, they would essentially say, this is your problem. You're responsible to fix that problem. And so that's really what the issue is. So getting the diesel cars into the country, you know, the movement's begun. You know, and people just, you know, we've changed the name of the fuel. It's the film. It's now called Fuel. People know about the film. People are buying diesel cars. And so there's now, like anything, like in any movement, when they begin, there's a sort of a shortage. And these people I would consider are the revolutionary people. They're the ones that are willing to take the risk, you know, and are really, you know, at the forefront of the cause.
I see. Well, considering the fact, and Texaco and Exxon and all the refineries and companies, oil companies, must know that eventually oil is going to disappear, and it might be sooner rather than later. So how many of them are looking ahead and working on biofuels themselves and may ease up this process of getting those cars because they're in the business of producing the fuel?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that.
Exxon and Texaco and other companies, oil companies, must know that oil is limited. The supply is limited. So they're, in order to make money 20 years from now or 30 years from now, they're going to have to give us something else. So why don't they get in the business? Are they in the business of giving us biofuels?
Another great question. You know, peak oil, we went to Portugal and we met with Colin Campbell. And he talked about, you know, the supply meaning the demand of oil, and that oil had peaked. And, you know, and most of the people, you know, who've worked in the oil industry have known that, and that information has never gotten out into the public. You know, if the supply can't meet the demand and prices keep going up, essentially oil companies become richer. So, you know, what's their incentive to migrate, you know, onto a new platform? You know, if oil's going to be around for 10 more years and they're going to be making $3, $4, $5 a gallon, like I said, what's their incentive? You know, I mean, this is where, you know, government's so important, and where they can intervene and where they can regulate and really, you know, ensure the prosperity of everybody.
Let's thank you very much for the call. Peter, unless you had something else. Peter's gone. Thanks for the call. Michael from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Michael.
Yes. Hi, Kathleen and guests. You folks are wonderful.
Thanks, Michael.
Okay. I hope you can hear me real time here. I'm on the cellular phone, so I'm not sure if there's a delay here.
No, we hear you fine.
Okay. I admire electric cars very much. And I think that when you folks were talking about maybe an apex or a, what would you say? I'm not sure of the word. When Edison came out with some things in the 1800s, and then, of course, Rudolph Diesel and some of these other folks like Ford and, I forget, the whole gamut of other people were working on different things, different ways to propel a horseless carriage, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so we chose the gasoline route. And so, or you might say oil or synthesized oil, which we found, we were beginning to find in the 1850s, as I understand. And so, as you say, it was plentiful and cheap, and so we went that route. But at this point, I can see that electric would be such a great thing. And no deference. I mean, I don't mean to be a condescending, any, disparages or anything about diesel, but I just see electric as being number one in this whole race of RACE, that is, okay, of propelling mechanisms for our vehicles. The electric, whether that be through coal or wind or solar, hopefully something that's sustainable. I really believe truly in the electric route here. Do you have any comments on that?
About the electric car?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, there's a great film by Chris Payne called Who Killed the Electric Car? Have you seen it?
EV1, et cetera, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yes, we've seen it.
Yeah, wonderful.
Interviewed him. It is a great film.
You know, look, I am totally a proponent of all of alternative energies. You know, are you going to ask me, is the electric car, you know, better than a biofuel car? I mean, they're all great. I think they all serve a purpose. You know, why limit ourselves just to one? I agree with you. I mean, electricity is a great source of energy, and we can make it, you know, through the wind. You know, and there's enough wind in North and South Dakota to run the entire United States electrical grid. So, and it's a free energy source. It comes from the sun. So, you know, I'm an advocate for what you're talking about, and I think it's totally, you know, available and accessible. It's really, you know, what it comes down to is, you know, who wants to put the money down and the infrastructure down to, you know, to mobilize this new green economy, you know, and where is that going to come from in order to enable, you know, those plug-in hybrids? I think that's really, you know, the issue of why the EV really hasn't, you know, evolved. But I mean, look at Toyota now. Look at the hybrid. I drive a hybrid. I think it's great. So I do believe there's a promise, you know, for the electric car, and I think that will only continue to grow.
And do you sense a marked change with a new administration when it comes to green energy?
Absolutely. Look, I was at the Obama inauguration, and I went, had the opportunity to film and blog. You can go on gregreitman.com, and you can check out my 4 video blogs. And I went to a bunch of green balls, and, the green economy is just at the forefront. It's like the dot-com where it was like 10 or 12 years ago. I mean, Obama's talking about a carbon tax credit. They've been talking about this for a long time. He understands it. He wants to do it. He's talking about alternative energy in his speeches. You know, I think people understand, you know, what it means. It means new jobs. It's a new sector. It's... you know, there are other proponents that are also enabling, you know, this particular change with T. Boone Pickens and the Pickens plan and, you know, and him understanding what wind is about and him being an oil guy but also understanding about energy. It's so there. You know, the question really is why weren't we doing it? And I think, you know, there was sort of like an apathy, like, you know, there wasn't really an urgency. And I think really what shifted us to move now into the green economy at a much higher rate was really the security issue. You know, I think that's really why the green economy is really going to move at a much, much faster rate, is because we've come to understand through war and our military presence that we cannot, you know, continue to buy oil overseas. We cannot, you know, continue to put 70% of our, you know, GDP outside the United States, you know, into regions of the world or countries in the world that don't like America. And so, you know, that's a national threat. You know, you can't be buying oil from a country that wants to go to war with you. And so every time we've been pulling that nozzle into our gas tank, we've been sending money abroad. And so what's really come full circle is we've come to realize that form of way of being is really fundamentally wrong and not necessary, and it's unsustainable. And what really shifted was to realize that we don't need to do that, that there's a better way, a more sustainable way, in order for us to make energy. And we've seen it with Brazil. I mean, Brazil, you know, in the 70s, you know, when we went to war with the Ayatollah Khomeini and Iran, you know, they shifted. They went and looked at ethanol, and look at them now. 30 years ago, their country is thriving. You know, they have an energy source that's available, that's in their backyard. They're keeping their money in their country. It's functioning. It's working. And they're having a great success rate. And I think America, obviously now sees that it can do the same and can be a leader at the forefront. And I think that's what's evolving.
Thank you, Michael, so much for your call. Let's go to Darwin next. Hi, Darwin. You're on the air.
Good morning. Howard Hughes, before GM shut him down when he was active and alive and doing very well, built a steam-powered car where you push the button, and 20 seconds later you could run on down the road, and about 30 seconds after that you could go 60 miles or 100 miles an hour as fast as you wanted to go. It had a variable stroke rear wheel crankshaft. That's how he ran his transmission. Okay, but the fact is, for 1 gallon of diesel oil, this guy could go about 250 miles.
Oh, my
gosh. His only byproduct was, this little tiny burning thing to keep his boiler hot, okay? And the other thing was water. That was it. I own 2 school buses run on natural gas. I can, for $11, I can fill up 4 huge 8-foot tanks, and I can fill my buses up, and I load, I've already got a ticket to prove it, to 40,000 pounds. And then school buses ran consistently 171 miles from Jamesville, Wisconsin, up to here, DeSoto, by the river, for $11. Now, we know that the doggone oil companies shut all this kind of stuff down because they want to make their profit purely. That's it. And times are due for a change, but we already have the technology available. Why don't we go back to Howard Hughes' steam situation and get back to natural gas? Because natural gas leaves nothing more than carbon dioxide. Plants love it. They grow on it. And water.
Let me get this right. You ran the buses with natural gas?
I have 2 of them in possession right now.
You have 2 of them now. Where do you get the gas? How do you fill them up?
You fill them up. They have stations all over the country. You fill them up to 2,400 pounds per square inch, and these huge 8-foot tanks. They look like oxygen tanks, And they work beautifully. All the system is built with stainless steel, lines and the valves and the switchovers and so on. So you start them up with gasoline, you switch over to natural gas right off the bat, and these things just run forever. The motors don't wear out because there's no dirt from the gasoline to tear the top ring and the cylinders and so on and so forth up. And these things run like champions. I've got 366 cubic inch GM big block motors, the old 455 Buicks and, Cadillacs and Tornados and stuff. Anyway, it's that type of a motor, but it's down to 366 cubic inches, and this thing just goes like a bat out of heaven, 70 miles an hour down the freeway, and you cannot ask for a better machine.
That's too fast, Darwin.
Well, 65.
All right, 65.
But it would go up and down, it would keep up with traffic on I-90 unless, that's the real part.
Right.
That's one, but the other one is Howard Hughes.
Right. What happened to him?
Why don't we use that?
All right, Greg.
Well, look, it's a great question. It's interesting. I was out in Carbondale. I was in Aspen, this year or last year, at a festival called R Day, Aspen Renewable Energy Day, that a colleague of mine, Chip Cummins, produces every year. And you see it. You see all of it. You see natural gas. You see hydrogen. You see biofuels. You see hybrids. Like I'm saying, it's all available. It's all there. I think really what this gentleman is talking about is, greed and, how a particular industry has controlled, that line of distribution for a very long period of time. And, now people are awakened. They're aware. They understand that there's a different energy source that's out there. And with the economy the way it is, when you can get an energy source that cheap, obviously you're going to go do it. And so that's what's evolving.
What about steam?
I think it was in history class, weren't our boats, our original boats, like in the 1800s?
Sure.
Didn't all that run on steam?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know too many, any people who are using steam now to keep the cars going?
There's like a solar show up in the Bay Area, and all of the, the new innovations come out. I haven't seen that yet, but I've seen a lot of innovations, but not that.
Mm-hmm. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Greg Reitman is our guest. He is producer of Fuel, a film that has just been released, and somebody wants to know when it's coming to Wisconsin, so I will ask Greg that in just one moment. It looks at just a number of issues, how we got hooked on oil, what oil has done to, in terms of pollution, heavy pollution of places in the United States that have a lot of refineries like Louisiana. It looks at alternatives, at biodiesel, at alternatives of the here and now, which may be algae. Our guest has said there are 1,000 different kinds of plants that could be used for fuel. It looks at consumption and pollution and global warming and what Germany has done and Sweden has done and how this is all tied into the world economy. It's an all-inclusive film. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, it's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Greg Reitman, producer of Fuel, is with us this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. I know where there were some problems with biodiesel. I was interested in what Las Vegas had done, and it's in your film, Greg, that they had 1,500 buses, I believe, on biodiesel. Is that still true in Las Vegas?
Story, right?
I'm sorry?
I said, what an amazing story.
Yeah, it was an amazing story.
Yeah, you know, it's just like, you know, what I love about that particular segment, I wasn't there in for that part of the filming, but I know Josh has been his big thing about converting, you know, every school bus across America on biodiesel. And what's really great is, you know, here's a particular city of industry that came together, that worked with, you know, a plant and saw, you know, an alternative that was available, and realized, you know, that he could make a difference in his community and on the young youth and children, and made that happen. Just a phenomenal story when you see it, isn't it, Kathleen?
Yeah, it sure is. Phenomenal.
You know, and it's really what it's all about. I mean, it's all really about the youth. It's all about the next generation of, you know, of well-being. You know, it's kind of really where my new film came out, Roots of Peace, you know, which deals with, you know, consciousness and the awakening the consciousness, you know, and people are alive and they're awakened, amazing things come out. And we see that, you know, in that particular excerpt in Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm. Here's an interesting email. A couple of them have come in. Wisconsin, it's from Clinton Appleton, has about 4.5 million passenger cars registered. Would we really have the waste restaurant oil or acreage of soybeans or Great Lakes seaweed to produce enough biodiesel fuel for any significant number of our cars? I doubt it.
Well, first of all, you know, one of the things that, you know, that particular individual is not looking at, it's like those cars are all gasoline-based, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're not diesel-based. So let's not get, you know, let's not get confused when we're talking about gasoline. We're looking at an E85 mixture, and we're talking about diesel. We're looking at like a B100, you know, a bio blend, right? So when you're asking of those cars, you know, are we gonna migrate them all into an E85 mixture? Yeah, potentially we could that, but soy wouldn't be the answer to that. That would be, for example, cellulosic ethanol. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah, it makes sense.
So, I mean, the question really needs to be looking at, you know, particular industry, and, you know, and in that particular instance, it may not make sense to, you know, put conversions and it really, you know, that's what I'm saying. You really got to look at the particular niches, you know, that are available. And I think, you know, with the transportation sector, if we're just looking at our big trucks and our goods and services that move, you know, goods across the country, and our buses, those are all diesel-based engines, and those usually have the dark crud, you know, fuel source. So why not, you know, immediately remedy that problem with the biofuel?
We go next to Roger from Milwaukee. Hello, Roger. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Both of you?
It seems like most of the conversation seems to be around not so-called a trade-off in fuels versus why don't we hear a little bit more about hydrogen or water, steam-type things. And the one that I'm not understanding actually is could be gotten going relatively quickly if they had the gas stations or the natural gas stations to be able to fill cars. But it seems like this natural gas seems to be the cleanest way to do it. You don't have to modify the way cars are manufactured. And it's a matter of putting like a propane tank in one so you can refill it. Where is his knowledge on these things?
Well, first of all, Roger, great question. And I don't want to come off as an energy expert, but I've been told that natural gas is very, what's the word? It's like it's very not safe. It can be a very dangerous fuel. In other words, it can, you know, it can light and, you know, it can have an impact. You know what I mean? Where it's very flammable. So I think there could be issues in that. But I think what you're saying is 100% correct, is that it's a very cheap, efficient mechanism that could be deployed and be used today. And you're really asking the question, which we've all been asking the question, what I'm hearing on the radio is why aren't we doing that? Like, when you go into a food store, you know, you see Diet Coke, Diet Pepsi, Sunkist, Root Beer. You know, why aren't there other flavors, you know, on the gas market for us as consumers to choose from? I guess that's what you're asking, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Basically, yeah.
I'm not a believer in the electric car because you're taking... The government or industry, no one's really regulated them to force them to open up the system.
Yeah.
You know, so there's been no one saying, look, you know, when, for example, Josh and I had the opportunity to go to Sweden, and in that particular country, the government mandated that by 2020, Sweden would need to be completely, energy independent off of petrochemicals, and you know, looking at and deploying alternative energy. We interviewed the oil company, Statoil. They were working. They were talking with us how they were working with the automotive companies and the retail stations to certify the fuel to make those particular renewable energy sources available. And here was an opportunity where you see firsthand where government, industry, and energy and automotive are working together to create a sustainable future.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't see that in America. What we see in America is the idea of incentives and allowing the free-based market economy to dictate what our energy policy is. And this is, you know, where governance has an opportunity to really have a much bigger stake and because look, right now, oil is the most cheapest market, and people don't realize that it could take about $4 to $5 to get that oil over to America, you know, the time it gets into the gas station. But the subsidies, you know, and the government, it only costs us $2. So who's picking up that extra $3 is the United States government. You know, and so this is where, you know, they have a huge stake in the balancing of alternative energy, and we saw that with biodiesel, where they had a dollar subsidy. So when they do that and they regulate and if they mandate it, you would see a much quicker infusion of those alternatives, you know, in the free-based market, and that's essentially where or what hasn't evolved yet, and it's coming. I really believe it. I think that, you know, the administration, Obama, is, you know, definitely looking at that and trying to figure out, you know, how to open up, you know, the market, you know, for, you know, new fuels to come out.
You were going to say something about electric cars. I'm sorry, but we can only hear one person at a time. Roger, go ahead.
No, because I'm not – when I think of the electric car, one, I look at it as a trade-off. Instead of – I mean, now I'm using electricity versus gasoline. Now, as a trade-off, I guess I would rather have an electric car than a gas car. But as I say, with what you've just discussed with natural gas and some of these other things, to me, we should really be moving away from both electric and gas, and we should be really looking for something that occurs naturally in
in our environment like natural gas, or something like hydrogen or a steam type motive. You know, I even wonder if there's if you could do a wind. You know, like you see those.
You could, because wind you actually can can transform into electricity. So the answer to your question is yes. I mean, all these things are all possible. And, you know, the interesting thing is we're such a car culture. You know, you can see we love our car. We love our freedom. We love getting and driving. You know, that's part of, like, the American dream. Nobody really wants to give that up. You know, but no one really wants to spend $4, you know, a gallon, you know, to live in that American dream. And so, you know, really, what Roger's really asking is what's going to be the next generation of, you know, vehicle that's going to empower America? That's right. What I'm hearing, right, Roger?
Right.
Much. I mean, and I don't think it has to be so much a different vehicle because, like, you know, they say apparently natural gas is a little volatile, as you were mentioning, but at least you know that you don't really have the manufacturers don't have to change the way they're making cars. It's still a product we'd be familiar with. It would just run on something different, you know. So, but really, this is fascinating. Do you think Obama should take away that subsidy so we see the real price of gas and maybe the consumer then will start to even edge more towards wanting to find an alternative?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, you can't just, you know, like, it's like, look, if we have an addiction to a problem, you can't just, like, you know, cut the plug right away. I mean, you know, I mean, having people pay $5 a gallon is not the answer. I think what the answer is a migration where Obama can move the subsidies, you know, from fossil fuels to renewables. And when you do that, then essentially governments level the playing field. So rather than, you know, where the lobbyists have permeated or penetrated the energy policy, you know, let's shift the energy policy where it's a clear playing field where, you know, that, you know, money or that subsidy money rather going into fossil fuels, which we realize is a finite source, let it go into renewables, which is an infinite source, which is really going to be expansive and is only going to help the planet, help the people, and really, you know, move our new, you know, green economy. I think that's the answer.
Thanks, Roger, for the call. We do want to ask you this question. Will fuel be available for Wisconsin viewers at some time, Greg?
Absolutely. I just want you to know, Kathleen, it's really great to be on the show. These questions are really, really good and definitely, you know, got my brain cells
good.
Working this morning. You know, I think last time I was on NPR radio at Sundance, it was the same type of questioning. Just amazing. It's really a hot issue. Yes, fuel will be coming to Wisconsin. You know, right now, Josh is getting, you know, inundated with inquiries all over the country. And so I've noticed that. And, you know, as his producer, you know, I've just taken the time to step up and to really help and do a little bit more media, a little bit more promoting of the film. Right now it's in L.A., it's in Oregon, it's in it's going to New Mexico, and it eventually will get to Wisconsin. I don't know the date exactly, but I know every day there's a call coming in from every state across the country wanting to see the fuel. And so, you know, we're doing it, you know, one theater at a time and with our marketing, and eventually it'll get there.
Great. We have time for one more phone call. Jim from Delavan. Hi.
Hi. How are you today?
Fine, Jim. How are you?
This is kind of interesting. It's something I've been interested in for a long time and have followed somewhat. One of the short-term hazards for people that are experimenting with vegetable oil or getting vegetable oil from restaurants, et cetera, and also the gentleman from Janesville who's running his buses on natural gas, is the fact that they're not paying road tax. And when Wisconsin Department of Revenue discovers that, they step pretty heavily on those people. The man in Sheboygan went public with his vegetable-powered diesel car, and Wisconsin Department of Revenue came to him and said, oh, now you owe us for so many hundreds of dollars of
really?
Road tax.
Really? Oh, I hadn't even thought of that.
Yeah, thousands of miles. And
yeah.
He says, well,
huh.
No, I didn't,
yeah.
But he has no way of proving it.
Huh.
And so that's one of the short-term handicaps of experimenting with some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Greg?
Look, we saw, no, great question. I mean, I didn't really understand your question.
Right, there really wasn't a question.
It was just really a point. No,
a
and I can, you know, I can, you know, further add to that we saw a huge surge in the market of people, you know, going after grease in the restaurants in California. It was, you know, I think it was like last summer when oil got really, really high and gas prices, you know, started to fluctuate. Restaurants were getting inundated, you know, and typically they would charge, you know, to take away, or people, companies would charge them to take away their vegetable oil. And, you know, they didn't have to pay for it. People were just asking to take it away for free because they could make it into fuel. So this is another, you know, again, you know, how, you know, movements begin, and when people, you know, when, like what you're saying, it's non-taxable and you can make it, but it's also non-insurable, and it's, you know, there are issues. You know, I don't promote, you know, making fuel out of vegetable oil out of restaurants. You know, it's not a certified fuel standard, and there is stuff, you know, in the back of those restaurants. There are particles and stuff that gets in there.
Mm-hmm.
Not very good for the engines.
So. And on that note, we have to say goodbye, Greg. We are plumb out of time. Thanks so much. Greg Reitman, producer of Fuel, and it will be in Wisconsin sometime soon. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, to John Treader for on-air production, and thanks for all of your sophisticated calls. I'll be with you again on Monday. All Things Political at 9. This is the Ideas Network.